We are in that very special time of year in Kesel Asar between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And I'd like to begin, as we often do, by addressing a certain halachic aspect of the day of Yom Kippur. And as we will see, this time it is something that relates to Yom Kippur as we will meet it this year. By way of preface, the Torah states, as we well know, with regards to Shabbos, Zachor es yom haShabbos lekadsho. And these words, Zachor es yom haShabbos lekadsho, constitute a mitzvah saseh, one of the 248 positive mitzvahs, which we call Kiddush. Now, the way that we perform Kiddush, again, as we know, a cup of wine and a certain formula that we say about Shabbos, and then we drink the wine. And the concept of making Kiddush over wine is derived in the Gemara, in Maseches Psachim, and Daf Kuf Zayin, from the Pasuk itself. For on the words, Zachor es yom haShabbos lekadsho, the Gemara darshans, Zachrei olayayin, that it should be remembered specifically over wine. And there's many explanations as to what it is about wine that makes it appropriate for Kiddush to be said over it. But whatever the explanation may be, we have before us this drasha that Zachor is al hayayin. Okay. However, the Rambam alerts us to the fact that on a pure Din Torah level, the mitzvah of Kiddush is fulfilled just by speaking. That is to say, all you need is words. You say something, in the Rambam's words, in the Shevach of Shabbos, v'kedushaso, something that's special about Shabbos, and you have already fulfilled the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Doraisa level. It is true that we do make Kiddush over wine. That's the Rabbanon. What about the drosha? After all, and this is a familiar discussion vis-a-vis last week, if the drosha states that it should be made over wine, doesn't that make it de'oraisa? Well, here's another example of the idea of asmachta, whereby something is mentioned and presented as a drosha, but in fact the din itself is de'oraisa, and however asmachta works, as we discussed last week from the Ritva, with regards to Malchus, Sechronos, and Shofaros, it's the inspiration for the Din Drabanan, but the Kiddush over wine itself is not de'oraisa. Then there's the drinking of the wine, which is certainly Drabanan. And what that means is we have before us in the mitzvah of Kiddush three tiers of halacha. You have the actual mitzvah on a d'oraisa level, which doesn't need to be said over wine at all. Then you have the asmachta, which says, Zachreihu al hayayin, that it should be said over wine, but that doesn't yet mean that you have to drink the wine. But of course you do. But the drinking of the wine isn't even part of the asmachta. That's pure, so to speak, d'rabanan. So we have all three levels right there within the mitzvah of Kiddush. And therefore, the first thing to know about Kiddush is that it does split up largely into those two domains. D'oraisa does not need wine, and then Midrabanan, it does. The Magen Avraham in Hilchos Kiddush says something else, says something further. Not only does the mitzvah d'oraisa not need wine, but in principle, the mitzvah d'oraisa of Kiddush can be fulfilled during davening. During tefillah, because when you think about it, and we should think about it, the tefillah of Shabbos is about Shabbos, Mekadosh HaShabbos, Vayechulu, etc. And therefore, says Magen Avraham, in principle, it is possible to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush D'oraisa in davening. Now, this idea of the Magen Avraham taken, shall we say, at face value, which it was by the Noda Yehuda in his Perush to the Shulchan Aruch entitled Dogel Meravava, leads to an interesting situation, because If we say that when a person davens on Friday nights, so they have already fulfilled the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Din Torah level, it is true that they have not yet fulfilled the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Drabbanon level, but that means when they come home from Shul and they make Kiddush over wine, that is to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush Midrabbanon, because the Doraisa of Kiddush has already been fulfilled in Shul, in davening. But this leads to a very interesting shaila, which many responded to. And that is, it happens to be that the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Doraisa level, or on every level actually, applies to women and to men. It's an exceptional to the rule, because even though Kiddush is a mitzvah saseh shazman gom, it's a positive time-bound mitzvah, and women are generally potter from such mitzvahs, nonetheless, by virtue of the unique fusion which took place in Shabbos, which is referred to as Zohar v'Shomor v'Dibur Echad Ne'emu, that Zohar and Shomor were said together, they were said together because they're fused together and they draw halachas from each other. Zohar refers to the positive mitzvah of Shabbos, which is Kiddush. Shomor refers to the negative mitzvahs of Shabbos, that is to say, not to do malacha. And because the two are combined and connected, whoever is part of Shomor, which is everyone, because negative time-bound mitzvahs are the domain of everyone, so too the mitzvah of Zohar applies to whoever Shomor applies to, and all are equally obligated in the mitzvah of Kiddush. That means a woman is obligated in Kiddush Daraisa as surely as a man is, and to the same degree. That being the case, as an Odeb Yehuda will meet the following scenario. Because if it is the case, and not hard to imagine that when the Odeb Yehuda was writing, it was the case that the husband has been to Shul and he's Daven Ma'ariv, the wife has not necessarily been to Shul and Daven Ma'ariv, so he has fulfilled his mitzvah of Kiddush Midoraisa, leaving him only, quote-unquote, obligated in Kiddush on a Drabbanon level. The wife, in the meanwhile, is fully obligated, not having Daven Ma'ariv, if she hasn't, on a Doraisa level. So she is obligated in Kiddush to a greater degree than he is. Now, generally speaking, we say that if a person is obligated on a Drabbanon level, they can't be motzi someone who's obligated to the greater level, Doraisa, which leads to the rather shocking question of the Odeb Yehuda, and that is, what is more traditional and what is more Shabbos than the husband comes home, makes Kiddush for the wife and family, and the Odeb Yehuda says, well, someone please explain to me how that works. His wife is obligated up to a greater degree than he is. The good news is it's okay, and therefore the Masera may continue, but one needs to know why, because just mathematically, we hear the question of the Odeb Yehuda. But if we put that question to the side, the Magen Avraham again has stated, and it's quite an assertion, that the D'oraisa mitzvah of Kiddush is fulfilled during davening. Rabbi Kiva Eger, in his comments to the Shulchan Aruch, seeks to adduce support for this assertion of the Magen Avraham. He wants to help him out and demonstrate that this is so. From where? Says Rabbi Kiva Eger, from Yom Kippur, when it falls on Shabbos. After all, and this is probably one of the things that it is easiest to forget, every Shabbos, there is a mitzvah of Kiddush. When Yom Kippur falls on Shabbos, there's still a mitzvah of Kiddush, because the mitzvah didn't go away. Zohar es Yom HaShabbos Lekacho is as equally true, as far as the Torah is concerned, for Shabbos Yom Kippur as it is for any other Shabbos of the year. And if that's the case, though obviously we understand that Kiddush over wine is out of the question, but nonetheless, Kiddush over wine is Derabbanon. There's no reason why the mitzvah on a Deraisa level should fall by the wayside. That remains an absolute obligation. But where does it go? We never find an enactment. We never find a requirement that even in the absence of wine, the person should still make Kiddush in some form or another. There's no such thing. But why not? Where did it go? The answer, says Rabbi Kiva Eger, is as the Magen Avraham said. For Magen Avraham said that the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Doraisa level can be fulfilled in davening. When you make Kiddush over wine, it's for Drabbanan. When it comes Yom Kippur, you don't have the option or the requirement of making Kiddush over wine. You're left with Kiddush Doraisa. But as Magen Avraham told us, that happens during davening. That's a separate question, slightly more complicated, so we can't so much go into it. Ask a rabbi. Now, so what Rabbi Akiva Eiger is reminding us is that when Yom Kippur falls on Shabbos, there's still a mitzvah of Kiddush. And the reason why it's important is because when it comes to mitzvahs, and certainly mitzvahs that are on a Torah level, we maintain mitzvahs tzrichos kavana, that mitzvahs require intent in order to be yotzei the mitzvah. If a person did something, he doesn't have intention thereby to fulfill a mitzvah. A classic example with regards to shofar, hatokeh l'shir, let's say he's practicing his tekiahs, and he wants to get there, and he does a perfect tekiah, shvarim, teruah, the whole thing, 30 sounds. But his intention was to practice and not to fulfill the mitzvah. He has not fulfilled the mitzvah, because in the absence of kavanah to fulfill the mitzvah, there is no fulfillment. Mitzvos, tzrichos kavanah. And that being the case, it's important to be alert to the fact that there is a mitzvah of kiddush embedded within the Yom Kippur davening for Shabbos, because without kavanah, seemingly, one would forfeit the mitzvah, which is not the sort of thing one wants to do. Not on Yom Kippur, and not any other day of the year. Yeah. Now, there is actually a further point. And that is that what we have described on Yom Kippur, that you fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush during davening, as demonstrated by Rabbi Akiva Eiger, because we didn't find it anywhere else, seems to be the case for all Shabbosos of the year. However, as we will see, it is not so. It is specifically on Yom Kippur that one fulfills the mitzvah of Kiddush during davening, and not during the year. And this is something that was raised by another of the greats, the Chasam Sofer, in his correspondence to Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And of course, the Chasam Sofer and Rabbi Akiva Eiger knew each other quite well. Chasam Sofer was married to the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. So that's not your usual son-in-law, father, greatest acharonim. In fact, I heard from my father, Zatzal, that when the Chasam Sofer was looking, the Shidduch was proposed, the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, he wasn't sure who to ask. Who are you going to get a straight answer with it when it comes to Shidduchim, even in those days? He decided that the most honest answer he would get about this young lady would come from none other than Rabbi Akiva Eiger himself. So he sent a letter to Rabbi Akiva Eiger and said, your daughter has been suggested to me. Can you tell me about her? Well, in time, he received a reply from Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who said, I can tell you everything positive about my daughter. She's wonderful, middos, the whole thing. There is only one flaw, which I feel compelled to mention. And that is, as Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the Gemara states that a person should do whatever he can to marry the daughter of a Talmid Chacham. And in that regard, I don't know if she has that qualification, but that's my fault and not hers. And that was Rabbi Akiva Eiger's response. So the Chasam Sofer has these, they corresponded with each other, of course, and Chasam Sofer says as follows. It's an important yesod, of course, as we can appreciate, these discussions go beyond the particular topic at hand in terms of the principles. We find, often it is true, that it is possible to fulfill the mitzvah, a mitzvah d'oraisa in a certain way, the pure mitzvah d'oraisa, and yet the Rabbanan proposed or enacted a specific way to fulfill that mitzvah. In those cases, there is an active value not to fulfill the Torah mitzvah in any way other than the way the Rabbanan said to fulfill the mitzvah. Because that's the best way, by definition. That's the most mehudar way. And therefore, says Chasam Sofer, the same is true with regards to our situation. It is true in principle that one could fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa on a normal Shabbos, a mitzvah d'oraisa of Kiddush just during davening. But that's not the best way to do the mitzvah. The best way to do the mitzvah of Zohar is the way the Rabbanan said to do the mitzvah, Zohreyu al Hayayin. And because that's true, it is recommended and assumed that a person actually does not wish to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush during davening, because to do so would be in the less than desirable way. And when it comes to mitzvahs, even though it's debatable whether one needs intention in order to fulfill the mitzvah, One thing is for sure. If you wish not to fulfill the mitzvah, you certainly will not fulfill the mitzvah. If you have a negative intent, right, you are saying, what I'm about to do, I do not wish, I wish for this not to be the fulfillment of a mitzvah, it certainly will not fulfill the mitzvah. And therefore, says Chasam Sofer, in any normal Shabbos where the wine is waiting for the person when he goes home, it is assumed that he does not wish to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush during davening. And what part, a corollary of that, is the answer to the Noda Behuda's question. Because the Noda Behuda says, according to the monk in Avram, you can fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush on the Torah level in davening, so when he comes home, he's already fulfilled that mitzvah, he's only, quote-unquote, obligated midrabbanon, says the Chasam Sofer. That's not true. As true as it is that one can fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa, but no one wishes to. They wish to save, so to speak, the mitzvah of Kiddush on the d'oraisa to fulfill it over wine. In which case, the husband and wife are both equally obligated in the mitzvah of Kiddush d'oraisa. Hence, he's motzia. However, that's only true. He will only be saving the mitzvah, the d'oraisa mitzvah of Kiddush, for the cup of wine, if there is a cup of wine, which is true on every Shabbos of the year. But when Shabbos and Yom Kippur coincide and there will be no wine, there is nothing stopping him from fulfilling the mitzvah during davening, and that indeed is what he should do. It turns out, therefore, that the statement of the Magen Avraham that one can rise of Kiddush during davening is something that we only act upon once in a while, and that is Yom Kippur, when it falls on Shabbos. All other times we do not avail ourselves of the opportunity, but rather actively wait for when we come home. There is a follow-up point, which is also made by the Chasam Sofer. We have spoken about the mitzvah of Kiddush only as it applies to Shabbos. So when Yom Kippur falls on Shabbos, you have that conflict. But when Yom Kippur doesn't fall on Shabbos, so then there's no mitzvah of Kiddush. But that's not necessarily true. Says Chasam Sofer, if you look in Rashi and Maseches Shavuos on Daf Yud Gimel, you will see that Rashi explains, based on the Gemara there, that the concept of Mikra Kodesh also requires that one say something in praise of the day and special davening, etc. Yom Tov is a Mikra Kodesh, and therefore we have special davening on Yom Tov. That's part of the mitzvah of Mikra Kodesh. It's very interesting. As far as we're concerned, things should be special for Yom Tov, so you should have a special davening. But the notion of special Yom Tov davening is part of the Torah mitzvah of Mikra Kodesh. And Yom Kippur is also a Mikra Kodesh, which means from a certain point of view, says Chasam Sofer, Yom Kippur always has a mitzvah of Mikra Kodesh, which translates into the tefillahs that we do. And one should also be aware of that. But that is inbuilt into the machzor. That's the tefillahs themselves. But this is certainly something which is recommended by Poskim, really from the time that Rabbi Akiva Eiger raised the question, and it becomes reiterated in different works throughout the generations. One should have in mind, ideally, that when Yom Kippur falls on Shabbos, when you get to the part that you mentioned praise of Shabbos, that is the fulfillment of the Doraisa mitzvah of Kiddush. So moving from halachic matters to more thematic matters. Yom Kippur is the 10th of Tishrei. And we look upon Yom Kippur as the end of a certain period of time that we refer to as the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, beginning with Rosh Hashanah, and then you have the week in between, and then you have Yom Kippur. And Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they form the poles of this season. Now, of course, thematically, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur seem to have a lot to do with each other, which means it's only natural that we look upon them as two brackets of a certain time in the year, a certain season in the year. However, there is a certain chiddush in looking at these two days as being connected. And the reason why is because if we look at the background of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they don't seem to have happened in a way that relates to each other, in the sense that Rosh Hashanah is Rosh Hashanah because it's the first day of the year, and that's the anniversary of the creation of man, and that leads to Malchios, and that's Rosh Hashanah. The institution, so to speak, of Yom Kippur, at least historically, the way it came into the Jewish people, was not apropos of Rosh Hashanah. it was actually apropos of something else entirely that preceded Rosh Hashanah by many weeks. And that's the Chet HaEgel. The timing seems to take its cue from the Chet HaEgel. It's a question of periods of time elapsed, those sets of 40 days, whereby the Chet HaEgel happened on the 17th of Tammuz. Of course, that's the origins of the fast day of the 17th of Tammuz, when the luchos were broken, the Egel was made. And then the next day, on the 18th of Tammuz, Moshe goes up for the first, for that middle group. He's already been up for 40 days from Shavuos until now. He goes then for an intermediate lot of 40 days, which begin with the 18th of Tammuz and culminate on the 29th of Av. So Slicha is secured. And then he goes up again, the third time, beginning with Chodesh Elul, and then culminating 40 days later on the 10th of Tishrei, which is Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, therefore, is established as a day of Kapara by virtue of the Kapara for that massive Aveira known as the Chet HaEgel. But when you look at it that way, none of this has anything to do with Rosh Hashanah, or anything to do, for that matter, with the fact that it's in Tishrei. It's simply the end of the third set of 40 days, which culminate on Yom Kippur. One could therefore have seen, perhaps, that these 2 days, each one has its own identity and its own goal, but not necessarily that they form a season, with one being the beginning and the other being the end. And therefore, it's important to note that we do look upon it that way, as if to say, it's not for nothing that the Yom Kippur ended up being on the 10th of Tishrei. 10 days earlier was Rosh Hashanah. Rather, it takes its place there. That's the day of Kapara, and it is the end of this 10-day period. But there is actually more to it than this. Not only for what we have said so far is well known, that there's this season called the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and it begins with Rosh Hashanah, and it culminates with Yom Kippur. It actually goes further than that. Because when we talk about Rosh Hashanah, so we know what we mean. Rosh Hashanah is the first day of Tishrei. And if for Yom Tov reasons, Rosh Hashanah is the first 2 days of Tishrei. And then it's Motzei Rosh Hashanah, and then it's other things. However, if we look in the Navi, we will see that there is perhaps a different definition of Rosh Hashanah that we might not have been expecting. The Navi Yechezkel describes a certain vision of Nebuah that he had, where in this Nebuah he was taken to Yerushalayim, he said he was taken to Eretz Yisrael, and he was shown what the Beis HaMikdash would look like, and he was shown what Yerushalayim would look like, and the various parts, etc. And the way that Nebuah is introduced in Perek Mem Pasuk Aleph, Yechezkel says, in the 25th year of the Golos, Rosh Hashanah, Be'asor LaChodesh. On Rosh Hashanah, the 10th of the month. Haysa alayyad Hashem, Ve'yaviyosi Shama. He had this Nebuah, and Hashem brought him to Eretz Yisrael. So he dates the Nebuah as Rosh Hashanah, Be'asor LaChodesh. Now, if we look at the Pasuk, and we know that Rosh Hashanah is the first day of the year, and of the month, and Asar LaChodesh is the 10th day of the month, you can't say Rosh Hashanah, Be'asor LaChodesh. Any child will tell you that if it's the 10th of the month, it's not Rosh Hashanah, it's Yom Kippur. But Yechezkel says, no, it's Rosh Hashanah. And really what he means to say is that in a broader sense, the concept of Rosh Hashanah, or the time that we call Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, is a period of 10 days. And it starts on the 1st of Tishrei, and it culminates on the 10th of Tishrei, which we call Yom Kippur. And all of that is called Rosh Hashanah. And the point that is being made here is that Rosh represents the beginning of something. Well, how long is the beginning? It might depend on the something that it's the beginning of. As surely as the beginning of the day will be sunrise. And how long is sunrise? A few moments. But that's the beginning. And after that, it's the beginning's finished. You're in the day already. when it comes to something like Rosh Chodesh, so how long is the beginning of the month? It's called Rosh Chodesh. One day begins a month. But when you begin a year, so in the broader sense, it's more than one day that begins a year. It's 10 days that begin a year. It's 10 days that launch a year. That's an entire period. It's made up of 10 days, but they're all called Rosh Hashanah. So Rosh Hashanah actually is a process which is 10 days long. It's interesting to see this idea play itself out in the realms of halacha, which it does, halacha d'oraisa, because in a sense the interplay, shall we say, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it comes out in a mitzvah that's in many ways very close to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and that is Yovel. For, as we know, the shofar is sounded in the Yovel year on Yom Kippur. According to many opinions, that is the source of the minhag that we have, that on Motzei Yom Kippur, we blow the shofar. You're not going to blow on Yom Kippur, but we blow it on Motzei Yom Kippur. And even though it was blown on Yom Kippur only once every 50 years, we do not wait that long. You do not want to wait that long. And therefore, we have a zecher every year. But the shofar was blown on Yom Kippur. What happens in the Yovel year? Well, as we know, land returns to its original owner, those fields. Avodim, slaves, they go free. And the Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah states that, or notes, if you look at the relevant psukim, it's not so easy to identify when exactly this happens. Because on the one hand, the pasuk says, V'kidashtem esachamishim shana, we mekadish the 50th year. The kiddush of the 50th year, kiddush ha-chodesh, happens on Rosh Chodesh, happens on Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei. U'krosem dror, and then you proclaim freedom. La'aretz echal yishveha. It sounds from that pasuk as if everything that happens in Yovel happens on Rosh Hashanah. On the other hand, of course, the pasuk says, "Va'avartim shofar trua, v'yom ha'kipurim tabiru shofar b'chol arzachem," and then everyone goes back, v'shavtem, isha lachuzoso, v'isha mishpachto. That's when everything goes back, and really, therefore, we seem to receive different messages from the different psukim in the beginning of Parshas Bahar. Do the halachas of Yovel, are they activated on the first of Tishrei, v'kidashtem, or on the 10th of Tishrei, v'yom ha'kipurim? And the Gemara explains that these halachas, the emancipation of the avodim, etc., it's a process. And it begins on Rosh Hashanah, and it ends on Yom Kippur. And what that means is that even practically, from Rosh Hashanah, they no longer need to work for the Baal HaBayit. In that respect, they're no longer in his employ. But they don't leave until Yom Kippur. So those 10 days, they're in limbo somewhat. That means that their emancipation has stages to it. And that's dated by Rosh Hashanah and by Yom Kippur. And therefore, through the Yovel, we see in action the concept of these first days of Rosh Hashanah as a unit. And things begin to happen at the beginning of this unit, and they culminate. And moreover, when we look upon these 10 days in this way, again, as this expanded form of Rosh Hashanah, it will make it much easier for us to understand how the two significant poles of this time, namely Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur themselves, each one, they cast their light on the entire period of 10 days, including the other special day. So Rosh Hashanah has special qualities, but Rosh Hashanah, in a broader sense, is all 10 days. And therefore, the qualities of Rosh Hashanah extend into all the 10 days, including Yom Kippur. Conversely, Yom Kippur has its own special qualities, but it's also part of the Rosh Hashanah, these 10 days. And therefore, they extend backwards to the whole 10 days, including Rosh Hashanah. For example, if we would express the unique quality of Yom Kippur, it's clearly that of Kapara. It's that Tshuva is that much more accessible, and Kapara is that much more attainable, and Tfilah is that much more powerful and readily accepted. And that's called Lifnei Hashem. Yet the Gemara tells us that the qualities of tefillah that we have just described, which are true for Yom Kippur and which are the trademark of Yom Kippur, are actually true for the entire 10 days. The Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah tells us that there is a certain efficacy of tefillah which exists in the 10 days, which doesn't exist throughout the course of the year. Even after Gzar Din, the individual almost has the power of a tzibur. That elevated status of tefillah, and what is it based on? The pasuk Dirshu Hashem Behimasa of Sika Hashem when he is found. And because he's found, it's easier to seek him out, and it's easier for tefillah to be effected and for tshuva to be accepted. Says the Gemara, when is he found? And the Gemara answers famously, Eile Asara Yomim Shevein Rosh Hashanah Liyom Kippur. These are the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, inclusive. And therefore we see that what we naturally would ascribe specifically to Yom Kippur works backwards, because Yom Kippur is the end of a process, which it's the end of a unit of 10 days, which means what's specifically true for Yom Kippur is ultimately true for the entire 10 days, even from day one, from Rosh Hashanah itself. Rosh Hashanah has aspects of Yom Kippur to it. Conversely, themes which we would associate and which we do associate specifically with Rosh Hashanah, but if you stop avoiding it, you'll see that they also appear in Yom Kippur. For example, at the center of Rosh Hashanah as a theme is Malchus, as we know. And moreover, the ending of the bracha, just to see how it's expressed halachically, the ending of the third bracha changes from Hakel HaKadosh to HaMelech HaKadosh. If a person, Nebuch, forgets and he concludes that bracha Hakel HaKadosh and not HaMelech HaKadosh, it's like he hasn't davened. He's got to say the whole thing again, because Rosh Hashanah, it's all about Malchus. It's the theme of the day. You can't ignore it. However, as we know, that very same halacha is as true for the ensuing days, including Yom Kippur, as it is for Rosh Hashanah. As true as it is that if a person forgot to say HaMelech HaKadosh in the third bracha on Rosh Hashanah, he's got to go back, and the day after Rosh Hashanah as well, when it comes to Yom Kippur, it is equally true. If he said HaKel HaKadosh and not HaMelech HaKadosh, he's got to go back, which means Malchus pervades Yom Kippur in this respect to the same degree as it does Rosh Hashanah, which for us is rather unusual, because we normally see these days as very distinct. They're part of a similar season, but each one really has its own separate identity. But we see that that's not the case. We see that anything that is central to the day of Rosh Hashanah is central to the time called Rosh Hashanah, including Yom Kippur. And thus does Malchus is as critical to Yom Kippur as it is to Rosh Hashanah. It's also interesting to note, and if you listen to the Misha Beiruchs, in between the Aliyahs, I mean, the Machzorim are getting more and more interesting, so there's certainly plenty to do in the Misha Beiruchs. But so how is Yom Kippur described? Well, how is Rosh Hashanah described? We say, Bavor Sha'ala Lechvod HaMokom V'Lechvod Yom Adin. Because Rosh Hashanah is Yom Adin. And then you come to Yom Kippur. And the Misha Beiruch for Yom Kippur says, we work at so-and-so, Bavor Shalach Vodamakam, Lichvod Yom Adin. And that could be quite surprising. Because, once again, isn't the whole thing that Yom Kippur, it's not really Yom Adin anymore. Rosh Hashanah is Yom Adin. Yom Kippur, you call it something else. Call it Yom Kippurim. Call it Yom HaSlicha. We call it Yom Adin. Because it's still part of that day. It's still part of that time called Rosh Hashanah that began on Rosh Hashanah itself, and we still call it Yom Adin. And the truth is that this is really what we say. I mean, it's expressed very pointedly in the Sana Tokev, where we say, Rosh Hashanah Yichaseimun, V'yom Tzim Kippur Yichaseimun. That whatever is to happen, it's written on Rosh Hashanah, and it's sealed on Yom Kippur. the sealing on Yom Kippur is the sealing of that which was written on Rosh Hashanah, which means it is a progression of the very same process. The writing on Rosh Hashanah is part of Din. The sealing on Yom Kippur is also part of Din. And in a sense, if we look upon the 10 days in that way, the inscription in these formative days, and that's really Rosh Hashanah are the formative days. They're the days that will determine the tone of the year, etc. And the beginning of the year takes 10 days. And the process of forming all of this begins on Rosh Hashanah, and it continues up until and including Yom Kippur. One could almost say that when it comes to the writing, so to speak, that takes place on Rosh Hashanah, it takes 10 days for the ink to dry. And that's a process. And then it's set. And that's the chasima. And aside from giving us, I think, a new perspective, and these thoughts are based largely on the work Ben Melech from Rebbe Leib Mintzberg Shalita, one of the greats of our time. Aside from giving us, I think, a new perspective on Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur as it relates to Rosh Hashanah, but it also gives us a new perspective on the days in between. Because we look upon the days in between, they're almost like caught between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And so Rosh Hashanah is the beginning, and Yom Kippur is Yom Kippur, and you've got days in between, so clearly there's something about them, but and we do our best. But the truth is that if what's true on Rosh Hashanah continues to be true until Yom Kippur, it must also be true in the intervening days. If Yom Kippur, day 10, is still part of Rosh Hashanah, then day 9, working backwards to day 3 and 2, is also part of Rosh Hashanah. And moreover, if Yom Kippur can already affect Rosh Hashanah in the time, it's in the sense that it's already a day that's appropriate for tshuva, then certainly the days in between, these aren't days that are like a lull or downtime, as they would say, between the significant days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. They're the in-between days of this duration. I think one could almost say that the week in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it's almost like the Chol HaMoed of Tshuva in that way. Chol HaMoed, it's not Yom Tov, but it's the Chag. It doesn't become non-Chag and then become Chag again. It's all the duration of the Chag, but except the beginning and the end are the poles. The beginning and the end of their Seris Mei Tshuva are the poles, but the days in between, they're the Chol HaMoed. They continue to have qualities of both. And their days of Din and their days of Tshuva. Their days of Din because Rosh Hashanah continues, their days of Tshuva because Yom Kippur has already begun to happen as part of Rosh Hashanah. And that's really why, and it's very interesting, just even simple questions, if there is such a thing, or basic questions, where on Rosh Hashanah we say Kosveinu B'Sefer HaChaim. So we ask Hashem to write us in, to Sefer HaChaim, because Rosh Hashanah is the day of writing, right? Rosh Hashanah Yikaseva. On Yom Kippur, it's the Chasima. And what about in between? We don't know. We just wait. The writing's already happened. The sealing has yet to happen. So nothing happens. But that's not true. Because on all the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we continue to say, V'kosveinu b'sefer HaChaim. You ask Hashem on day 4 and 5 to write you in. But the writing took place on Rosh Hashanah. But Rosh Hashanah is still happening. It's happening for all 10 days. And moreover, again, just to note, as much as we say that Rosh Hashanah is the time of ksiva, of writing, and Yom Kippur is the time of chasima, but for most of the time on Yom Kippur, we still talk about ksiva, because in our terminology, the ink is still what hasn't dried yet. Until Ne'ilah, we don't talk about chasima yet, even though we say on Yom Kippur it's the chasima. Seemingly, we should be saying v'chosmeinu from Kol Nidre. But we don't, because it is only at the end of Yom Kippur, that's the end of a 10-day long process. But day 10 is still part of the process, and we're still talking about the Kosveinu. So this is all very, I found, eye-opening. And moreover, says Rav Mintzberg, not only have we identified through so many ways, through so many features of the days, and the aspects of the days, and the Navi Yechezkel, and so on and so forth, that Rosh Hashanah ultimately is a 10-day long unit, culminating in Yom Kippur. But It's possible to say that because it's Rosh Hashanah, because it's the beginning, that's what's responsible for the special qualities of the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. They derive from the fact that it's the beginning of the year. When it comes to Rosh Hashanah, it's in a sense easier to see. The din of Rosh Hashanah is a function of the fact that it's the beginning of the year. It's that significant time. Everything's beginning again. Everything's being renewed. It's a new cycle. And apropos of that, right, with respect to that, the din takes place. There's an assessment. How is everyone? With the ramifications and consequences for the year ahead. That's the unusual thing about Rosh Hashanah. If it was purely din in the retrospective sense, there's room to say that Rosh Hashanah should not be the first day of the year. It should be the last day of the year. And din happens at the end. So every year should conclude with Yom HaDin. But it doesn't. The year begins with Yom HaDin, because the din is really about what's to happen for this year, in light of what's happened last year. But it's about people's circumstances and their how things will be for them in the coming year. There is no more appropriate time to make these decisions about the coming year, to make these judgments about the coming year, than the beginning of the year. So Rosh Hashanah is a day of din because it's Rosh Hashanah. It says a Minzberg, but Rosh Hashanah goes for 10 days. And it culminates in Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur is a time of Kapara. And Yom Kippur is a time of Kapara also because it's part of Rosh Hashanah. And it's a very wonderful perspective on what it means to be the beginning of a year. The way that we relate to time is that it's kind of a living entity, and it has characteristics. And when a person does something in a certain time, it makes its mark on that time. And a person, from a certain point of view, is only free, fully, of the effects of what he did at a certain time when he enters a new time. And this is something that we find with regards to Tumah, for example, the halachas of Tumah and Tara, as the Sokhot of a Rebbe discusses in the Avni Nezer in his commentary to a Sefer Egle Tal, where, as we know, if a person has become Tomei, so how do they get out of it? How do they rid themselves of their state of Tumah? Well, they go to the mikvah. And then they're tohor. But that's not entirely true. In many respects, they retain vestiges, shall we say, of their tumah until the next day, what's called Harav Shemesh. That's the very first Mishnah in all of Shas. When are the Kohanim allowed to eat Trumah if they become Tomei? Not from when they go to the mikveh. From the next day, Mishah Shakonim, Nichnas Lecha B'Trumasim, Seisah Kochavim. Why? Says Egle Tal, because if they became Tomei in a day, so as long as they're in that day, they haven't fully rid themselves of the effect of the Tumah. But as they move into a different day, it's a new time zone, it's a new time frame, it's a new field, and therefore they have none of the effects, and therefore if they make a change, it's completely new, and they're completely tar. Says of Minzberg, the same is true with regards to Yom Kippur. Kapara, as a way of leaving everything else behind, part of what makes it possible is that a new time frame is beginning, a new year is beginning, which has none of the qualities of the old year. And therefore, if a person makes a clean break, the time for that change to fully happen is at the beginning of the year. But once again, that highlights and emphasizes the quality of Yom Kippur as partaking from the fact that it is the beginning of the year, beginning of a new year, new possibilities, new time frame, and absolute kapara is made possible. So these are the thoughts of Rav Leib Minzberg, and it occurred to me, perhaps it's a feeling. If we go back to the minhag, and it's not a halacha, but it's a minhag, that on Motzei Yom Kippur we blow the shofar, and we blow the shofar every Motzei Yom Kippur. And as we said, some say it's a Echel Yovel, and others say give different interpretations. But it's very interesting that, in a sense, we blow the shofar on Motzei Yom Kippur to indicate that a certain time period has finished, because it began on Rosh Hashanah and it's kept on going. In other words, Motzei Yom Kippur is not just the end of a day; it's the end of a period, it's the end of a season, it's the end of this unit which is called Rosh Hashanah, which lasted 10 days. And when the whole thing is over, we blow the shofar to signal that that's over. And moreover, we conclude it in the way that it began. In other words, on Rosh Hashanah, the Torah provides that there is a mitzvah called Tkiyah Shofar. And that's, in a sense, what launches Rosh Hashanah. To the extent that Rosh Hashanah keeps going for 10 days, we conclude it the way it began. And Minhag Yisrael is the final thing you hear from Yom Kippur is a shofar. As if they say, that's the bracket. And now Rosh Hashanah is over. So in terms of perspective, these are some very eye-opening ideas. And moreover, if we once again look at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as being so intimately connected, we do see that a lot of Yom Kippur draws from the themes of Rosh Hashanah. At the center of Rosh Hashanah is Malchus, as we say. And that's what the day is devoted to. And then if you look at your Machzor, any page of the Machzor in Rosh Hashanah will have the concept of Malchus in it. And then we move to Rosh Hashanah, to Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur is about Kapara. But Kapara is also building off Malchus. The Kapara of Yom Kippur, it's a progression from Malchus. How so? When we appreciate what Malchus is, we say that Hashem lokeis v'melech u'malchus v'kol mashalah. Malchus is about control, it's about guidance, it's about the king is in charge and is full potence. Well, we need that for Yom Kippur. Because the concept of Malchus, which means Hashem is in control, and therefore the king can act in his kingdom as he wishes, we need that, because we're going to be asking for that when we ask for Kapara. Because the truth of the matter is that when we ask for Kapara, we're asking for Hashem to break the rules, for him to break the rules that he himself set up. Because the rules say that there is no Kapara. The rules say that there is certain cause and effect. And moreover, cause and effect, when it comes to matters of mitzvahs and averos, that is the spiritual nature of the world. This is something that we perhaps don't normally focus on. The only cause and effect that we're aware of, I think, in our experience, is physical cause and effect. Anything which is spiritual, or as far as we're concerned, has no rules. But that's not so. Spirituality also has its rules. In fact, much of what we call a miracle is actually the higher nature of spirituality imposing itself on physical nature. And it takes precedence, and it can override those rules. So if Avraham Avinu is a big enough tzaddik, so he's fireproof. I mean, that's really what we're saying. As surely as there are materials that are physically fireproof, human beings are generally not. But if you're Avraham Avinu, you are. That spiritual nature imposing itself on the physical laws of cause and effect. But what can impose itself on the spiritual laws of cause and effect? There doesn't seem to be anything higher. Spirituality is the highest, and that's its nature. So what can override that? What is the higher nature? There is no higher nature. So the only one who can impose himself on that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, who set up the laws of cause and effect. That's Malchus, as Melech. As surely as on Rosh Hashanah we talk about Hashem as Melech in governing and arranging the affairs of this world, so then we progress on Yom Kippur to talk about it as Melech in terms of arranging our own affairs, as only a Melech can, because we're asking to essentially to break the rules that he set up. There is a famous statement in the Yerushalmi in Maseches Makos, which many have spoken about, which states, Sha'alu l'chokhma, they inquired of wisdom. If a person sins, what should happen? Nefesh achotes matei dina. How do you inquire of wisdom? I don't know. But they did. And what's the answer? The answer, it's a pasuk in Mishlei, Chata'im tirdof ra'a. The sinner should be pursued by evil. And that's that. Well, as is often the case, it's sometimes a good idea to seek a second opinion. So the Gemara says they asked Nevuah. Same question. Someone sins, what should happen? In Nevuah, quotes a pasuk in Yechezkel, ha-nefesh ha-chotes, hitamus, the nefesh that sins should die. So far, Chachma, very bleak. Nevuah, very bleak. In the end, they asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he said, Yase tshuva v'yiskapi, should do tshuva. The whole Gemara is an enigma from beginning to end. Because Chachma doesn't sound so smart, and Nevuah doesn't sound like he'd ever read any of the Nevi'im. Because if you did, he'd know what we all know, and that is you can do tshuva. So what does it mean to ask Chachma and Chachma to not know? And to ask Nevuah and Nevuah doesn't know? Rabbi Yosef Leib Bloch Zatzal, tells the Rosh Hashiva in the Shiurei Das, explains that the concept of Chachma and Nevuah are two ways of sizing up the nature of the world in all of its emanations. Chachma looks at the nature of the world around and deduces upwards. Nevuah sees the nature of the world from the highest realms and then proceeds downwards. And neither of them saw the option of Nevuah. And in terms of their frame, they're right, because they represent ways of looking at the makeup of the world, and the natural makeup of the world doesn't have room for tshuva. It doesn't have room for the restorative or reparative elements of tshuva. It can't be done. It can't be reversed. If something is set on fire, it's the end. It can't be restored. It's ashes now, even if you're sorry. And that's all they could say. When it says they asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that means that the ultimate answer lies beyond any way of understanding the nature of the world. And Hashem said, okay, it doesn't make any sense in terms of the nature of the world. But it's an overrule. It's an override. Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can give the answer of tshuva, which we gratefully accept. But that's a miracle. It's interesting to see how these things are woven into the Nusach HaTfilah. We say in Ne'ilah, there's two concluding paragraphs, which is what makes Ne'ilah unique amongst the Tfilahs. One of them begins, Atano Sein Yad Laposhim, V'mincha Pshuta Lekabel Shavim, as we know, the very emotive paragraphs, those two. So translated, Atano Sein Yad Laposhim, you give hand or extend a hand, we would say, to sinners or the rebellious ones. V'mincha Pshutim, and your right hand is outstretched, Lekabel Shavim, to receive people that are doing tshuva. So the question, of course, is what is, and we know these two phrases, right, and we cherish them, but what do they mean? What's the difference between them? Are they two ways of saying the same thing? Yad laposhim, yimincha pshuta lekabel shavim. They're the same. The hand is outstretched to receive tshuva. Although if in the second phrase we say yimincha pshuta lekabel shavim, your hand is outstretched to receive people doing tshuva, it sounds like the first phrase, they're not even doing tshuva. Atanei nosin yad laposhim, they're still rebelling. But then what's the hand outstretched for? Nothing's happening. Moreover, the first phrase, we pay close attention, the first phrase talks about atanei nosin yad laposhim. You give your hand. Which hand? Doesn't say. Maybe it doesn't make a difference. The next phrase, yimincha pshuta lekavoshav, your right hand is outstretched. So how come it's of the essence in the second phrase? It's yimincha pshuta. And moreover, if your right hand is called yimincha, then what is yodcha? Well, as Mefarshim tell us, and the Gemara even says, Ksubas and Daphei, that whenever the pasuk refers to Hashem's hand and his right hand, then the hand is the left hand. Obviously, it's the non-specified hand. So now that means that Hashem's left hand is extended for Poshim, and his right hand is extended to receive people who are doing tshuva. But what's the difference between the left and the right? Well, the Peirush Siach Yitzchak, which is the Peirush found in what's called the Siddur Hagra, Rabbi Yitzchak Maltzen, who's from the Beis Medrash of the Gra, explains that the difference between the right and the left, as obviously we're using highly borrowed terminology when we talk about Hashem's right hand and his left hand, but there are two ways that Hashem operates. He operates within inside of nature, beyond nature, and that's the right and the left. The right hand is the stronger hand. Its strength is reflected in or represented by even overriding nature. The left hand, the relatively milder hand, is the one that guides nature. And that's actually what we say, says Rav Maltzen, earlier in the Tfilah, for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. When we say, Kemoshe Adano Hashem Elokeinu Shashalta Lefanecha. Hashem, the control is with Hashem. Oz biyodcha ugvur biminecha. Once again, we have yodcha and yiminecha. And if yiminecha is the right hand, yodcha is the left hand. So oz is with the left hand, and gvur is with the right hand. What is oz? Oz is strength. And gvur is might. And what is the difference between oz and gvur, strength and might? Says the Siach Yitzchak, the strength referred to in the left hand is the strength that guides the physical world. The greater gevura, so to speak, of the right hand, is the one that overrides the nature of the world. And therefore, says the Sefer Shiras David, who is actually a Rosh Hashiva currently in Tells, that's why we say, Atanosen Yadla Poshim, Hashem's left hand is extended to Poshim, but the left hand is Hashem working within nature. And what does that mean? Poshim sounds like they're not doing tshuva. That's correct. Not yet. But Hashem doesn't relinquish them. He uses his left hand and extends it to them. But what does that mean? No one's doing tshuva. What's he responding to? He's not responding. He's initiating. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't give up even on the Poshim. But what does he do? He maneuvers events of this world at certain times to arrange certain events or certain meetings or certain experiences, whatever it may be. People have their stories, how they came to change their life's direction. Something happened to them. But why did it happen to them? And how did things happen in that way? That's Hashem's left hand. That's Oz B'yodcha. And that's the Yad that's extended to Poshim even before they've even thought of doing tshuva, to spark something within them too. And then, when they come to do tshuva, V'yimincha pshuta l'kabel shavim. Hashem's right hand is open, extended, to accept them as they're doing tshuva. And why is that called the right hand? That seems relatively easier. But as we've said, once they are appealing to do tshuva, they're asking for a miracle. They're asking for an override of nature on every single level. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do it, of course, but he does that with his right hand, because that's gevura b'minecha. That's what's involved in terms of the healing of tshuva, to reverse any destructive effects that would otherwise be considered absolutely irreversible. That's yimincha pshuta lekabel shon. And I'd like to conclude by referring to, but if we appreciate, just to finish that segment, that's what we mean, therefore, when we say that the kapara of Yom Kippur is also drawing off Malchios of Rosh Hashanah. Because Malchios of Hashem as being in control, controlling all the forces of nature, capable of overriding all the forces of nature, that's exactly what we will be asking him to do as we ask for kapara. And therefore, Malchios is the base of kapara. So again, that's the cohesion of Rosh Hashanah, the themes of Rosh Hashanah and the themes of Yom Kippur. But if we may conclude with a thought that also relates Malchus to Yom Kippur and how Rosh Hashanah leads into Yom Kippur in that way, and they're all part of certainly of the same progression. There's a famous question that was asked by Rabbi Yitzhak Petterberger, Rabbi Yitzhak Lazar, the Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. We take it for granted, and also there's nothing we can do about it, that Rosh Hashanah comes before Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah is Yom Adin, and Yom Kippur is Yom of Kapara, and that's how it is. And therefore, we get into a bit of crisis over Rosh Hashanah, or we should, and then we try and sort ourselves out before Yom Kippur, where hopefully things will end well. We are assured, if we do our best, that things will end well. Except, Rav Yitzhak asked, what if it was the other way around? Wouldn't that be better? Wouldn't that be easier? Wouldn't it be better to come to Rosh Hashanah already having had Yom Kippur? Because then you're absolutely clear, and din is cut. Why do you have to take the harder route? It's almost like we go into this trauma of Rosh Hashanah, and then 10 days later there's Yom Kippur. You know, if I had Yom Kippur a week ago, so then I'd feel much better about Rosh Hashanah. And of course, it's not hard to appreciate that that's really part of the answer. Because the last thing you want to do is to enter Yom HaDin in a state of complacency. So maybe we do need first-hand Rosh Hashanah and begin to take like seriously. And then Rosh Hashanah will work and then Yom Kippur will work. The alternative, we may not even take either of them seriously. We take Yom Kippur for granted because we didn't have Rosh Hashanah beforehand. And we take Rosh Hashanah for granted because we think we had a good Yom Kippur. But there is a further point. And that is, from a certain point of view, if we don't have the Malchios of Rosh Hashanah, we can't really do tshuva. Not only in terms of the results of tshuva, we can't even go through the process of tshuva because we won't really appreciate what it is that we're coming back to or what it is that we're even apologizing for. In the Sefer Tal Chaim, which is a very special sefer by a contemporary Mechaber, he gives a mashal. But what's important to realize is that the Malchus of Rosh Hashanah, as we began to speak about last week, it's not only, so to speak, about Hashem. But the full emanation of Malchus, if Hashem is the king, so we're his subject. So the subtext of Rosh Hashanah, the full picture of Rosh Hashanah, is also about us. It's about placing ourselves. And it's only when we have that picture that we can begin to think about what we need, what we've done wrong and what we could be doing right. Otherwise, it could be that even our apology is really for a fraction of what really we should be apologizing for. If you can imagine someone who said, this is the Tal Chaim, who fell asleep in the king's courtyard, which is and then he made a mess. And it's a terrible thing. He's woken up and he can't stop apologizing. Why? Because he made a mess in the king's courtyard, and he'll get out of there as soon as he can, because to make good on a bad situation. So the Tal Chaim, that's all well and good if he's a stammer person. Imagine the very same scenario is true for someone who's part of the royal family, for someone who's part of the king's entourage. So when he falls asleep and there's an important event that's happening and he misses the whole thing and he wakes up, so the worst thing he can do is to apologize for making a mess. He doesn't even know what to apologize for. It's not about making a commotion in the courtyard. It's about not being where he should have been. There's something that's very important and he wasn't, which he should be a part of, and he's just completely derelict. It's completely absent. Without the consciousness of Malchus and its implications for us, says the Tal Chaim, our tshuva on Yom Kippur would be a fragment of what it really is, because we'd be apologizing for doing things wrong. And we should apologize for doing things wrong if we need to. But the real question is not, what have you done? The real question is, where have you been? Because this world with Hashem as Melech means we are his subjects, and we have our contribution and we have our place to make. If we don't have that consciousness, we don't even know what we're apologizing for. And therefore, says Tal Chaim, first comes Rosh Hashanah. You've got to know what the world should look like, and you've got to know what your place in the world should look like. And then tshuva is getting to be there and trying to make good on perhaps having been absent. But that's really where the vidui and all of those things, they're all about that ultimately. And so Malchus, as we said, the picture of Malchus, the map of the world given to us in Rosh Hashanah of Malchus, gives us a map for where to return on Yom Kippur itself. And with that thought, it's a shame we should approach the holy day of Yom Kippur, take full advantage of every moment, and us together with all of Am Yisrael, to have a good year.